Gay Mormon Stories is a production of Mormon Stories and the Open Stories Foundation. To support this podcast, please donate today at gaymormonstories.org. All donations go directly towards keeping the podcast alive and towards building a community of support for lesbian, gay, bisexual, transgender, and queer Mormons. And thanks for listening.
Okay, but so in the meantime, you're attending Evergreen, but it sounds like even though you had these doubts on your mission and it was obviously impacting your relationship to the church, you were still trying to be a Mormon. So
yes.
What's going on with your relationship with the church during all of this?
I was still attending a singles ward. My bishop knew that I was still dealing with my SSA or SGA or whatever acronym they use to not refer to it as gay, because heaven forbid we actually say the word. But yeah, so he knew that what I was struggling with, and he was like, you know, you shouldn't be going to rated R movies, and like made this list of things like that's worked for other members who were also struggling. You know, it's just, I'm like, how the hell does rated R movies have anything to do with anyway,
okay.
Really, like, I'm gonna watch, I have no idea, Silence of the Lambs, and just really just think that that's
so what's you weren't buying all the party lines, but you were still trying to be Mormon,
right?
You
right, were, right.
There was that was your was this your motivation for doing the reparative therapy? Was that you kind of somehow wanted to still be a Mormon? And
yeah, because again, there's the social pressure, there's the culture, everything and everyone around me was Mormon and not gay.
Yeah.
For all I knew. So I was towing the line of what was expected, and doing everything that I could that I thought I was supposed to be doing. But then there just came this point where I'm like, well, I'm going to go do this and have a relationship. There wasn't really any sex involved, but enough that I could feel some intimacy and emotional connection. So I met this guy from Denver online, and we would fly out to see each other every few weeks. And he was not convinced he was gay either. And then he moved to Sacramento, I believe, for a job, and then was really realizing that he was probably gay as well. And he was starting to get into some real estate stuff that wasn't going so well. And, so... I worked at a loan office during that time, and I got an email from his brother in the middle of the workday saying that he was found dead in his bedroom, and that they were trying to figure out if it was suicide or not, and that he didn't know who I was, but just knew that I had been on a list of his contacts on his Hotmail account or something that he emailed a joke to. So he knew me from that list.
Goodness.
So he didn't know that his brother was gay, didn't know who the hell I was. He was originally from Oklahoma, and so the funeral was there, and obviously I couldn't go because everyone would be like, why the hell are you going to Oklahoma?
But this was even while you were seeing him.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
And you just had no idea that...
I mean, I knew he was kind of dealing with some issues, but I also later found out that he was doing some drugs, and I was kind of naive to that whole thing. He was doing steroids, but on top of that, he was doing GHB. He was doing muscle relaxers. He was doing sleeping pills and human growth hormone. And so, I mean, there's a steroid.
He wasn't doing drugs to get high. He was doing drugs to fix his self-esteem.
To fix his self-esteem, yes. And then the muscle relaxers and the GHB to kind of, you know, whatever. I haven't done either. So it just seems like that scared me into really not wanting to do that.
Did it seem like then maybe it was just an accidental?
That's what his brother said, that it seemed like an accidental overdose. And I believed that for a day. And then I felt like, you know, I think he had just had enough, and because he took enough that it was like borderline, maybe I'll just take a few more than I should because I'm feeling really shitty, and if I happen to die, then I die, you know?
Okay.
I kind of feel like that was probably his mindset if I were in his shoes. Yeah, and that tore me apart because I felt like I, being a member of the church, knew better than to have, you know, any sort of sexual intimacy with another man. And here I dragged him into this downward spiral that's caused his demise. And so, I mean, I was bargaining with God. I was, you know, bawling my eyes.
So you actually framed it as being something that you helped contributed to because of drawing him into the homosexuality.
Right, right.
Wow.
Yeah. And I was, I mean, I would drive to the temple and just sob and would just say things like, you know, God, please just put the sin on me and not on him, you know, just save him from whatever awaits him. And please, you know, I was so broken and I felt like I had just disappointed God as a whole, really. And when I finally went to tell my bishop what had happened and that I'd stopped going to this group therapy and didn't go to the therapist anymore and that I'd actually messed around with this guy that I was dating, he proceeded to ask specifically what we had done when I had come to him for some spiritual guidance because I was completely torn, like heart ripped apart, you know, like heart and soul, what the hell am I doing? Why am I even here? I've fallen in love with somebody and they died. Like, what am I supposed to do? And he basically said, well, you know, you are a Latter-day Saint and God expects more of you than this. And I believe that Brent passed because you're not supposed to be in a gay relationship. Because, you know, as Latter-day Saints, we're living a higher standard. And from my seminary classes and books I'd read, you know, it seems like if you're born in, as a Mormon, raised in a Mormon family, you're kind of more elevated than the rest of humankind, apparently.
So he just decided it was your fault, too.
Not that it was my fault. I guess sort of in a roundabout way. But just that anyone else is expendable. If you're a Latter-day Saint, you know, you're expected to live a higher law, and God is saving you for a higher purpose, and everything else is expendable, including him, including Brent. And that was the turning point. When he started asking me exactly, like, what I had done, I'm like, well, we fooled around. Like, you know, there was some oral sex. We jerked off. And then he wanted to know if I was wearing my garments. And I'm like, okay, well, this is probably standard procedure. But then he started asking, like, you know, if I had pulled them down or if I had them half on and, you know, were his hands underneath or on top. And I'm just like, dude, are you getting off on this? Like, really? Is this completely, especially with the situation, absolutely inappropriate? And I have not read anywhere where a bishop is supposed to be asking where hands were placed and if genitals were, you know, coming through the garments or on top or if they were some, if they were semi off and what exactly went where. And I'm just like, what? He's getting off on this somehow, whether it's a power play or a sexual fantasy or something.
But unfortunately, this is the dynamic that gets set up with this idea that they have to discipline you.
Right. And so he's like, well, you know, I don't think this is worthy of excommunication, but possibly this fellowship. And I just was like, you know what? Fuck off. You have no idea what you're talking about. You can't relate to me. And I don't trust you or believe you are my spiritual leader, because this is not what I expected at all. And then he said, well, what did you expect? You had sexual relations with someone of the same sex. That's, you know, the sin next to murder. And I was like, okay, we're done. And then I never went back to church.
How old were you by that time?
God. It was after I performed at the Olympics. It was in 2003, 2002, 2003, yeah. So I was, I have to do some math. Hold on.
Well, that's great. let's go back and tell the parallel stories. Sometimes we tell the happy story first, but I mean, there was some other stuff going on in your life during these years. So what? Why don't we fill in the other half?
Okay.
Your career there, your music.
Oh, okay. Well, I had been, while attending Evergreen, I had played the part of Joseph in Joseph and the Technicolor Dreamcoat for about 9 months back to back in various theaters around Utah, because as soon as Donny Osmond played the part, then it was like Utah's favorite musical of all time. Okay. So I toured around doing that, did some other musical theater, and then the governor's office asked me to perform at the opening and closing ceremonies reception because they wanted to feature some of the local talent, because obviously the Olympics, they were bringing in all this other national stuff.
Yeah.
So I got to meet a lot of the dignitaries and celebrities and stuff. It was a pretty cool experience. And that is what I thought would, you know, kick off my music career, that this, you know, this would finally make something happen.
Were you also still writing music?
Yeah, I was. I released my second album in 99, I think, 2000. And it was a little less churchy, a little more rock, a little more introspective, and, you know, addressed things like my parents' divorce and things like that in it. So it was a little bit more non-religious, but it was still inspirational in a way. And it seems like that's kind of a recurring theme even in my music today, that, you know, it's not really religious, but there's still, I kind of hold to that, you know, things get better type of an attitude. And that, like I'd mentioned before, that all paths lead to the road that you're supposed to be on. And there's, you're where you're supposed to be because that's where you're supposed to be right now.
But meanwhile, so you're creating a name for yourself. I mean, it sounds like you were becoming fairly well known, partly because of your role in the show, but also you were known as a local songwriter and singer.
Yeah, I got some awards from some local, you know, newspaper like Salt Lake City Weekly, and, you know, some various other things like best songwriter, best singer, and I put a band together called Shades of Gray, and then another band called Found, and wrote a song called Shades of Gray, actually, when I was starting to go through the XK therapy. And again, hindsight 2020, listening to this song, I'm like, oh my God, this is about me dealing with my sexuality and realizing the world wasn't so black and white anymore. And in the final verse of that song is the conversation I had with my bishop and therapist about this being an illness. So the last verse in Shades of Gray addressed the bishop/church/therapist situation, you know, saying that my same gender attraction disorder was from being molested and all these things that were out of my control as a child, like being exposed to pornography as a child apparently was another one that I sort of believed, but not really. Because again, all we had was a Sears catalog, and if the underwear section made me gay, then it should have made everyone else in my household gay, right? And so in the verse, it says, so the doctor said, son, you've got a terrible case. It must have been in the water or something you ate, but there's nothing that I can really do for you now. And I say, excuse me, sir, pardon me if I shout, but do you know what you're talking about? I don't think you can read my mind. And when I perform it live, I use a couple of explicitives just to kind of get the punch at the end. But that's exactly how I kind of left the church, that, you know, you just...
But you were performing this and seeing this still as a member.
Yeah, not realizing that that's how really... That was the core of how I was really feeling inside. Like I was that passion and that emotion, and that's, you know, that feeling went into the song. And then I slowly realized that's how I was feeling, you know, and the verses about, there's other parts in the other verses that are about finding someone that's similar. And that was partly Brent, you know, and realizing I, you know, someone else kind of knows what I'm feeling. The rest of the verses kind of explained my feelings about finally finding someone that felt the same way, Brent, for instance. So I quickly realized, like, this is where my story is. It's in my songs. Trying to think, like, what other music stuff was going on at that time.
Well, but tell me more about the Olympics then. I mean, so you got invited to perform sort of in the receptions.
Yeah, the opening and
fancy parties that.
Yeah, that the governor. Yeah, the governor threw. He at first I got an email. And I thought it was spam because I'm just like, what the hell is this? And then I read it again a few months later and realized, oh my gosh. They're really asking me to do this. So I called and they said, yeah, you know, it's you and a couple of other local little celebrities that we've asked to take part in this opening and closing ceremony reception to be held at the Art Center next to the stadium. So when all the dignitaries and the government officials and celebrities are done, you know, doing what they're doing, they come to this, you know, this after party. It was pretty cool. And I think I was the only one with a camera. Because everyone else was already famous, it seemed like. I'm like, oh, I'm going to be the dork with the camera.
Get a videotape of it, or
no?
Exist in a recorded version? Or...
Nope.
Oh,
nope. No cameras and videos were allowed. So, yeah. And they spelled my name wrong. They put two T's in my last name. I was really upset. But whatever. Yeah. People still do that, and in fact, there's other instances where I've been introduced as Jason Utley on stage, and I'm like, yeah. Okay.
Jason, just one of those Jason.
Wish it could have been a little more creative on my parents' end, but gotta just kind of run with what I got. So, yeah, so that was really cool, and I thought that would open up a lot of doors, and it did, in a way, for some additional performances in Utah, but as far as like getting out, nothing happened. Like, you know. I was told from the very beginning, you know, it's really hard to make it as a musician in Utah. You have to leave if you're going to do something big. So I started thinking about moving and where I would want to move. And there was a writer in New York that had posted something online wanting to know about Henry Stuart Mattis, who had committed suicide back when Prop 22 happened.
Right.
And that sparked my interest about Prop 22 and what the hell that even was. And it kind of pissed me off because I was like, okay, well, wait a minute. 13th article of faith, isn't it, that we allow everyone to worship how, where, and what they may? Like, where is it our business to be involved monetarily and politically, whether it's a moral issue or not? Because anything could potentially be one. You just have to say it is. That really made me mad. And it wasn't just because I was gay myself. I was just like, how dare my church meddle in the lives of families that aren't even Mormon? Like, what? Like, this is ridiculous. So I looked into it a little bit more and contacted the guy that was doing the research and sent him some of my music. And he's like, you know, I have some contacts out here in New York. We'd love to have you perform at a couple of venues. And so I flew to New York and performed a couple of shows, did some fundraising events, played for some children patients at the Presbyterian Children's Hospital in northern Manhattan. Some of them were like, you know, terminal, some weren't, but, it, you know, I just went in and introduced myself and played him a couple of songs and signed him a CD and stuff. And that was really, really cool. And I started writing some new material. Left the band that I was in and kept writing with one of the guitarists from the band. We're still very close and still writing today, actually, together. Nice. Yeah, he's fantastic. And he came out to New York and we released a new album and I moved to New York City in 2006. I released the album at the end of 2005. And that album was called Runaway. The songs I really feel was kind of an introduction into some of the things I'd been dealing with, but I didn't want to be so specific in the songwriting that it alienated the general audience. Like, you know, I wanted someone to listen to it and be able to really pull the emotion from it and the feeling from it and not just the specifics, you know, because I didn't want to be, again, so descriptive that it kind of left people going, I can't relate to this at all, you know? Yeah. So like Room to Breathe, the first song on that album, was about feeling claustrophobic in this culture and social network of Mormon rules and regulations and laws that suddenly started surrounding everything, and not even considering myself Mormon anymore, I was still, it seemed like with the laws in Utah and the legislature, it just seemed like it didn't matter if you were Mormon or not. You were still babysat as a member. It just really frustrated me. And then also dealing with some issues with my stepmother, who felt that my mother wasn't strict enough. And so I only dealt with her wrath for a brief while. I actually moved in with my grandmother while I was at the tail end of high school and into college because of the issues that were going on. She had six kids that she brought into the marriage with my father. You know, suddenly I had a curfew. Suddenly, if I missed church, there would be consequences. And she was having some problems with her kids, and so she kind of just bled it onto me and my brothers. And it was just really unfortunate. The tighter and tighter she tried to squeeze, the more and more her kids rebelled, and she tried to put the same pressure on me, and I'm just like, I'm out of here. So I moved in with my grandmother. So that same feeling of ruling with this fist, and it's just not how I want to live. You know, you can't dictate my life. So
how long were you in Utah sort of after you stopped going to church?
About a year and a half. Uh-huh. And then I actually, before I left to go to New York, I wrote the church a letter and self-excommunicated myself, had my name removed. And some of my friends had asked, well, why don't you just leave your name on? Like, why do you got to be so dramatic about it? Just, they'll leave you alone if you leave them alone. I go, actually, no, they're not leaving me alone. Missionaries aren't coming to my door, but they're involved politically in things that I don't agree with. And I feel, and still do, that any organization that you belong to should really respect and value your name to be a part of their organization, that you're bringing something to that organization that wasn't there before. And if they can't value that or choose not to, then you should have enough self-respect to take your name off of that organization. Why should they have the honor of having you as part of it? And some of my Mormon friends kind of rolled their eyes at that, but I felt like I have honor in my name. I value who I am, and if they're not, unless I play by their rules, why should my name be on their list of members of their organization? And that was that. I sent them this letter, and you know, they sent me back a letter saying, you know, you have a 30-day money back guarantee if you want to come back. I just, you know, otherwise consider everything canceled, which I thought was a little interesting, like that there wasn't some ordinance undoing, you know, something like the unplacing of hands or you know, instead it's just like they just hit control delete, you know, where everything else was always this big ceremony, you know, of being ordained this and blessed this and given this in the temple, and suddenly all they had to do was just say okay, right. And it was done
on a computer screen,
right. And then I was yeah, it's just kind of odd. Yeah, I felt like I could speak out and not feel like I needed to protect, and nor did I want to protect the church, because I felt like what they were doing, the things they had done in the past, and the miseducation that I received about their history, you know, forcing me to make a decision based on not the whole truth. Right. And letting me make my own mind up about it and how I feel about it, was reason enough for me to just say, this is it. And now I'm going to go my own way, and I'm going to make my own life, my own path. And, actually, let me go back a little bit. After Brent passed away, I got another job at another loan office, and the president of the credit union was monitoring my emails. None of them were very explicit, but on my lunch break, I would go to like gay.com or whatever, like for personals, like personal ads and stuff. So she, after business hours, went through my computer and started just going through everything. And then the next day, she came back and just asked me point blank, are you gay? And I said, well, yeah, but does that really matter? She said, actually, it does, because the members of this credit union wouldn't want you working here. And frankly, I don't either. And I lost my job because I was gay.
Discrimination.
Yeah. Yeah. And I called Lambda Legal. I called the ACLU. And they're just like, welcome to Utah. You can be evicted from your house. You can be in the middle of getting a mortgage. And if your neighbors find out you're gay or the seller, they can rescind the sale immediately. There's no federal protection or state protection against any of that. And that just infuriated me. And so here I had lost my faith, lost my boyfriend, even though looking back, it probably wouldn't have lasted knowing what I know now. But, and then my job, and was feeling extremely worthless. And I was talking on the phone with one of my friends and, had mentioned, you know, it'd just be better if I just didn't exist at this point, because I just, that's how I feel. And it was pretty descriptive, to the point where he got a little panicky and called 911 after I got off the phone, and called, the police went to visit my dad's house, because that's what was on my driver's license, even though I wasn't living there at the time. Uh-huh. So like my stepbrother gave them my mom's phone number and address. So then they stopped by my mom's place, and then my mom calls and freaks out. What the hell's going on? You know, are you okay? And you know, that kind of reeled me back in. I actually jumped in my car and just drove, because I just kind of was, you know, fleeing the situation. But then the police called my cell and just said, look, we got to meet you. We got to make sure you're not going to harm yourself or anyone else. You know, you have a really concerned friend, and a really good one at that, that cares a lot about you. So we need to just make sure you're going to be okay. And I'm like, all right, I'll go ahead and meet you on the corner of, you know, whatever and whatever. And they said, well, and your mom's, you know, practically hysterical. So I said, well, tell her to just stay put, and I'll talk to her after this ordeal is over. And again, actually, okay, so let me rewind a little bit before that. I came out to my family, starting with my mom, after Brent died. And she basically said, you know, I feel like I failed you as a mother, because you felt like you couldn't tell me this for so long. Did you think I would love you any less? Number one. And number two, now I'm never going to meet somebody that meant so much to you. So please don't let it happen again. And that was kind of the beginning of, wow, you know, like, totally different reaction than I thought. I thought she was just going to say, you know, no, this is a phase, or, you know, even though she wasn't Mormon, you know, just, you know, you, oh, you're not gay, you're just confused, or, you know, you're just having issues with women. So then I just slowly started to tell my family one by one. And my dad was the one that had the hardest time with it. He actually went through the church's therapy as well, and they gave him the same story that, you know, he failed as a father, or my mother was overbearing, or I was exposed to pornography, or that I really was molested, and now I'm just recanting. And finally, I just said, you know, Dad, if you're, you know, I've been through this, and I've been going through this for 20-something years now. You going to therapy for 6 months and telling me to read the same books that I've already read isn't going to change anything. And if you believe in a God that is going to separate me from you because of who I love in this life, and only because of who I love in this life, then we don't believe in the same God at all. And frankly, I don't want to know yours. And ever since then, it's kind of slowly opened his eyes that the world isn't so black and white. Maybe there is more than one path back to, you know, wherever we're supposed to be going. So fast forwarding back to that dark evening where I was dealing with some suicidal thoughts. So my mother was hysterical, wanting to know where I was and if I was okay. I told her to stay put. So I was out to my family now at this point, out to some friends, who actually, half of which didn't want to talk to me anymore. Some said that the ex-gay therapy made me gay, that I wasn't really gay and until I went through the therapy. Okay. Because apparently they know better than I do. And of course, you find out really quick what your friendship is based on. And sometimes it's actually a matter of their own comfortability with sexuality in general. They just don't want to deal with it. And so, yeah, I lost a few friends that way. Anyway, so I went to go meet the police where they said that I should meet them and talk to them. And I told my mom to stay put. So I get there, get out of my car. There's like police tape everywhere. There's an ambulance. I was just like, okay, you didn't need the parade. Like, I'm fine. I'm just having a really hard time. And this police officer asked if I was Justin. I said, yes. He kind of pawns me off to this woman police officer, and she takes me to her car and puts me in the back seat and locks the doors and walks away. And I'm like, what the hell? Like, I'm in a parking lot in the back of a police car, and there's this huge like fire truck and ambulance in the middle of the street. Like, you know, at least if I have to pay for this, I at least want to ride somewhere. And actually, my mother had followed the police and ran a red light trying to make sure that she could see me. Yeah. And she got into an accident with a Dodge Ram, and she was in a little Geo Metro type of car. And it basically just went monster truck on top of her. So the reason they put me in the cop car was so I wouldn't go hysterical and try to get into the scene. So they pulled her out of a window and put her on a stretcher and took her to the hospital. And I just had to sit there in the back of the police car and watch it all happen. And then the police officer came back in and he's like, you know, we just got to make sure you're okay. And then we'll go take you to go see your mom. And I'm just like, you know, I caused this, I did this. And he's like, no, your mother loves you very much. And he's like, so what's the issue here? And I could tell he was Mormon by, you know, some of the paraphernalia he had in his police car. Like, you know, you pull down the dash or pull down the visor, and he had like the traditional Mormon version of Jesus with blue eyes and blonde hair or something. Or, you know, and a CTR thing, you know, so I knew. I said, well, actually, I just lost my friends that were Mormon. I'm dealing with being gay. I lost my boyfriend, and now I lost my job all because I'm gay. And he's just like, you can't lose your job. That's impossible. That's illegal. I'm like, well, you're a cop. You tell me. How come they could do that? And I couldn't sue them, and nothing was done. And he just kind of sat back, and he was just like, wow, I'm so sorry. And just kind of sat there in silence for a little while, and he kind of realized, like, it's like, I'm sorry, my church is kind of not helping your situation. I said, well, I don't need to hear that from you. That needs to come from the top, which it still hasn't. They just kind of tiptoe around saying it, or their PR firm does it for them. Anyway, that's another story. So he took me to the hospital, and I sat in the emergency waiting room till about 5 in the morning, and I think it was about 10 at night when it happened. And my mom finally comes out with like braces on all over the place, and a neck brace, and you know, crutches, and she's all bruised up. And she sat next to me and basically said, if this is what it takes for you to know that you are loved exactly the way you are, and that you're valued more than anything else in this world to me, then I'll do this again. And that's when I realized, like, I need to get my shit together, and I need to see someone that isn't associated with the church and help me get my mind and my heart and my soul back in line. Because right now at that point, they were just scattered, you know? So that's what I did. I found a therapist outside the church. She actually wasn't even from Utah. She had moved there recently and was just kind of amazed. Like, she says, yeah, it seems like, apparently, you know, you're only nice if you're Mormon. She said that I've been approached by a few people, asked if I was a member, and I said, of what? And they said, of the Mormon church. And I said, no. And they said, wow, really? You're so nice. She's like, what? And I'm like, yeah, welcome to Utah. Apparently you're mean if you're anything else. But I really found, you know, that I was dealing with a lot of compound grief and things that I really didn't grow up with the coping skills of how to deal with those things, and realizing that I finally found a way to put things back together was amazing, and it took about a year, but you know, I came out of it a stronger person and felt like finally I could start moving forward with my life instead of trying to repair it, and that I was exactly where I was supposed to be at that point in my life.
Well, and your mother came through amazingly for you.
Yeah, she's been an amazing influence, and she's been my biggest fan. So I couldn't have asked for a better mother. She feels that she failed me because of the whole divorce, and you know that they didn't work things out, and that she should have just waited till we were all done with school. But you know, as an adult now, I see that you know adults aren't perfect either. They make mistakes. I think my dad could have compromised a little. My mom could have told the line a little more, I guess, or you know, made sure that their marriage could have just still been as successful as they could have made it. But they decided not to do that. So this is kind of the way life rolls. But apparently it's all going to be cool in the afterlife because, you know, my dad still owns my mother.
Well, can't they just cancel that with a push of a button like your membership and your...
Yeah, but my dad doesn't want her to divorce him on the temple side. So she is still on there. Yeah. She's basically like, yeah, if you really think I'm going to be in the same room with your stepmother, making spirit babies for some planets with your father, no less, who I can count on one hand the number of times I'd had sex with, then no. Not going to happen.
Okay.
Yeah, maybe a little TMI.
Well,
but
some good things came out of it just the same. Huh?
Yes, yes.
Okay, so... You ended up going to New York then. So how did that come about? What was the first decision to leave Zion and go to Oz, Land of Oz, the Emerald City?
Yeah. Well, I had met a friend who had been posting back on... Connection, when that was still around, that social media site that had a little bit of a gay slant to it. Someone had posted a message saying that they were wanting to write an essay or a story on ex-gay therapy and gay Mormons, and he was having a hard time actually getting a real story because it seemed like anyone who was still involved in the program still had reservations about opening up completely, either identifying who they were or felt like it was painting the church in a bad light, so they weren't going to say anything negative. So I replied, and I just said, you know, I've been through the therapy, been through the whole nine yards, and I'll tell you whatever you want to know, open book.
Yeah.
And replied to him, and he interviewed me. He asked, you know, what I did in Utah, and I told him I was in finance but also doing music, and so I sent him a CD, and the next thing I know, he said, you know what, there's a few places here that are very interested in having you perform. So I flew out to New York to do a fundraiser for a few organizations, and then ended up performing at the Children's Presbyterian Hospital for some of the terminally ill kids. And I was just like, man, I did more gigs in 1 month than I had the whole year in Utah.
Yeah.
It just seemed like if you're not an Osmond, it, you know, you're not going to get very far in Utah, at least at that point.
Right.
So I started to really consider moving to New York City. A lot of people were like, you know, why not L.A. or Nashville? But I just was really drawn to New York, and it was amazing to see so many different cultures and races and religions and, you know, micro communities that all had to work together to make the city work. It was just fantastic. And I didn't really want to ever think about moving anywhere else because it just seemed like this was such a blend of so many different things that, you know, going from a bubble of everything being the same to a, you know, New York's kind of a bubble in itself too, though. But, but yeah, it's just so many different things here. It's just, I mean, every day is a new experience. Every day I meet something different, someone different.
Yeah.
That I had never, who I hadn't met before, hadn't experienced. So I spoke to my boss at the bank, and they were actually opening up branches in New York City.
So the bank you were working for in Salt Lake City.
Yes. They had some branches opening up in New York, and I was like, well, I'm interested. And they're like, okay, well, go ahead and apply for a position. And I did. And they said, okay, be here in 2 weeks.
Okay.
It was kind of freaky. Yes. Because, you know, I'd always talked about moving out of Utah. And then when, you know, push comes to shove, it's like, oh, shit. Now I got to do this. It was exciting and scary and exciting and scary all at the same time. Very intense.
So what year was this?
That was 2006.
Okay.
So I had, I sent in my letter to resign and take my name off the church records. And I kind of felt like it was the right thing to do. It was an empowering moment because I kind of, I got some feedback from some people that either went through XK therapy or even just, you know, Jack Mormons per se. We were just saying, well, why don't you just, you know, just go on with your life? Why do you got to go through this whole name removal thing? It just makes them more involved and you're just prolonging, you know, something that's negligible according to them. But for me, I felt like any organization that has my name should value who I am, what I am, what I bring to the table, and really value the fact that I am on their list of members. Yeah. And it took me a while to really get to that point, but that's how I feel today. And I was like, well, if they're not valuing who I am and all they want is a 10% cut and, you know, I don't even get the perks,
right?
Then no, you know, and especially if they don't value what I represent and who I am. So absolutely not. And I wrote my letter, and they of course sent me a letter back saying I have a 30-day money back guarantee, no questions asked. Please come back. You know, if not, we consider this done. And it kind of caught me off guard a little bit, because I'm just like, okay, well, all this ceremonial ordinance stuff going on, you know, from baptism to the temple, and then it's all just done with control alt delete, you know, like
pushing a button or
right.
a sign of a pen, and it's all null and void.
Right, right. So it's like
your baptism, your endowment, your
yeah, like
nations are all
30 something years of ordinances just that were done through a ceremony are just undone with just a click, you know? It's like I was like, wow, that was kind of anticlimactic, but
well, I hate to be snarky, but I hope that the people who you did their endowments for the dead are still hope those are valid.
Oh God!
I suppose they have to go back and redo those, do they? No, that's a terribly snarky thing to say, but it does kind of, you know,
right? I guess they have to keep track of that if they're really serious about the whole redeeming the dead thing. Which we know they are. So it was an empowering moment for me to have done that, and then I felt like now I can move forward with my life. And of course, fast forwarding a little bit, when Prop 8 happened, I kind of felt like, okay, wait a minute, I didn't want anything to do with the church, and now they're poking politically into the lives of people that aren't even Mormon and throwing money around, and it just really pissed me off. You know, a lot of Mormons I remember on my mission,
you left the church, but the church wasn't leaving you alone,
right?
Chasing you and persecuting you, and that's
You know, I'd heard the opposite when I was on my mission, like, oh, but, you know, people that leave the church can never leave the church alone. They're always poking at it and mad at it. You know, they're just very angry. And now I've seen the other side of the coin. I'm like, absolutely not. It's the church that won't leave people alone that don't even belong to it. Like the Proposition, you know, 22 and Proposition 8 and the Equal Rights Amendment and so many things that they had no business in. All they had to do was just say it's a moral issue and that's what God thought and they could get involved. It just really blew my mind. It was really frustrating.
The theocratic states of America, I guess.
Right.
Is that what we're trying to be?
Exactly. Or the plutocrats or whatever. whatever other person that's at the top of the food chain trying to make the calling the shots. So I moved to New York, still had my little halo of existence in Utah, like everything was still warm and fuzzy sometimes. I remember going to a bodega at 3 a.m. just because I knew I could. And getting some soda and a pizza, and I opened the door for this older woman who was pushing a cart full of groceries and laundry, as they do here in New York. And she like grabbed her purse out of her cart and like held it to her chest, and she's like, "What do you want? My money?" And I'm like, "No, I'm just being nice and opening the door for you." And she's like, "Oh, what are you, a fucking Boy Scout?" And I looked at her.
Welcome to New York.
Yeah, I looked at her and I said, "Actually, yes, I am. I got my life scout. Didn't quite get my eagle." And she's like, "Oh, well, that's nice." And she walked in, and I called my dad the next day, and I said, "You know, this whole like Eagle Scout thing you said would like open doors for me, and I'd get a job because of it." And I just said, "I just got cussed out by some old New York woman for opening the door for her. So no, none of this is applying to me. I'm not tying any knots. I'm not building any fires." Well, but it is sort of wilderness survival merit badge.
Courteous, friendly, and all yeah, those other things.
Sure.
That scout is.
Yes, yes. My dad was scoutmaster for like 80 years. So
yeah,
as far back as I can remember. So he was always involved. And trying to get us involved too, but New York's been great, and it's just so many opportunities had started coming my way. But I started to get lost and caught up in the scene of everything. I mean, in some areas of the nation, if you are gay, you kind of only have a choice of maybe 4 or 5 different bars. And you know, if you have a certain fetish, usually the nearest person that shares that is a few hundred miles away. Where here, you've got the gay community, which is more like just the city itself, really. And you can, if you have a particular interest, whether you're straight or gay, you can find that community of people that share the same interest. And there's a lot of them. And it's just crazy that the dynamic of the community here, and I guess in any huge city it's the same.
So what neighborhood did you move to right off?
I was in the East Village, so it was kind of a little artsy bohemian little
Alphabet City.
Just on the cusp. I was on First Avenue and 13th Street.
Is that, I mean, in the early 90s that was really where all the cutting edge things were happening in that little neighborhood. Is that still the case, or has the edge moved out to Brooklyn or something?
It's kind of moved everywhere, really. There's no more hub. Okay. It got really sanitized with Giuliani.
Okay.
He kind of installed the police where he wanted to dilute the culture and the community of any particular area. He would just install police there for a good month. They would be on every corner in all the parks, and they would just, you know, people that were kind of hanging out would just slowly have to leave.
Okay.
Yeah.
Because, I mean, even Rent was certainly based in that neighborhood, right?
Yep. Okay. Same thing. So it's kind of lost its old New York charm as far as culture goes, but some of it's returning in little pockets, but not like it was. I mean, Williamsburg in Brooklyn is kind of the hipster part of town now with a lot of artists and things.
Uh-huh.
But it's also got a lot of attitude that comes with it, I think, in some areas where, properties in Brooklyn are now, in some areas of Williamsburg, more expensive than parts of New York.
Wow.
Yeah, because, you know, real estate is saying, well, you have a view of the city. And you're in Williamsburg, this artistic community of, you know, amazingness.
Yeah.
Where we, you know, talk to our coffee while we brew it, and we're just so much better for that reason.
Yeah.
But I slowly kind of got caught up into the whole dating scene, because I was just like, oh my gosh, there's so many people, and, you know, because I didn't have any successful relationships while I was in Salt Lake.
Yeah, well, it makes sense that you would jump in and
Yeah.
And you're in
well,
New
but
York.
Well, but of course, I jumped into the very first shiny object that I saw, and okay. in Chelsea, and it was just a horrible experience. And the few friends that I had at the time were just like, "Don't do it, Justin. You're just fresh off the boat, so to speak."
You mean you entered a bad relationship?
Yeah. I mean, it was just all about visual and nothing about substance and intellect and character and anything that balances everything else out, you know?
Yeah.
And moved in with him within like 3 or 4 weeks. It was just really fast. And then once we moved in together, I realized this is absolutely not what I thought this was going to be. So that ended, 8 months later, 6 months later. And just kind of got lost in that whole dating game. And I've kind of come to realize that not all the time, but more often than not, Manhattan, is a city of single people that are here for their careers, here to make it, here to go to school, you know, and people enjoy being single here, and there's nothing wrong with that.
Yeah.
It's just that when people want to settle down, it's hard to do that, A, in an environment of so many things moving a million miles an hour. Like, why would you want to settle down and slow down when everything else is moving so fast? And second, there's always something around the corner that could potentially be better in one way or another than what you have, and so people kind of tend to, and again, I'm generalizing, but a lot of people, and this is true in both the straight and gay communities here, it's just, you know, some people have one eye on what they have and another eye on the menu in case a special comes up, because, you know, someone could walk around the corner with a better job or a better nose or a better apartment, you know, and if they want to find someone that has a one up on what they have, they will find it. So it's just about really building something with someone that you kind of end up, that people end up missing here because they're so kind of caught up in the one up process, I think. So it's so there's a lot of heartache there.
And you were pulled into the dating scene, but were you also pulled into party scene? Were you tempted to start doing drugs and party all night and the stuff that's available, you know, some of the other stuff that's available in a city like that?
No, I kind of was squeamish about the whole drug scene before I'd even moved here. Uh-huh. I wasn't a part of it at all before, and it just never appealed to me. It actually bothers me when I'm in an environment where there's a lot of drug use. I mean, I'd go to different clubs and things, but I would go to clubs in Utah too, but it's just that they're more available in New York. So, and last call, isn't it 11:45 or whatever it is? you know, it's at 4 a.m.
First call.
Yeah, exactly. And then it's 2 a.m. And then it starts up
before 2, it's early.
And then it starts up again at 5, you know? And then it was cool to kind of find my niche of friends and the type of people that I like to hang out with and common interests and things. And
so for New York, you were probably hanging out with a relatively conservative bunch then.
Yeah.
Did you meet other professionals? Did you, you know, people who had...
In Utah?
No, I mean in New York.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. People in the performing community, you know, in finance. I mean, all sorts of different walks of life. Like, I'd gone to Fire Island a couple of times. It just...
Because you're in two worlds. You're, as far as your career goes, you're in this sort of... You're in the finance sector, which is, you know, you think of three-piece suits, and then you're an artist, so you think of the absolute opposite of the people who, like...
Well, and then...
spit on the people with three-piece suits, right?
And so exactly.
Do you sort of... Is it a little bit schizophrenic that way for you?
A little bit.
Both worlds?
A little bit, and it's a little draining, too. Like, I have to use my creativity and my energy toward, you know, furthering Wall Street, where at the same time I need to have some creativity left to further my passion and in my music and stuff and my expression. But then also I kind of got caught up in the gym crowd, like the gym scene, you know, and I actually lost track of the whole music thing. I just got really caught up in the whole, you know, I got to have bigger arms or bigger chest or look this way or that way because that's hot, and just really got caught up in it big time. And I Didn't waste a lot of time doing it, but enough time now that I'm just like, damn it, I could have taken that year and done something else with it. But I ended
up... So what, you were doing 6 days a week of gym?
Oh, like...
2 hours a time.
Probably 9 days a week. Just really pushing it. And I had to get a gum graft because I had some issues with periodontia problem from my teenage years. So I had to have a gum graft during that same time, and they put stitches at the roof of my mouth from where the graft took place, and they told me to take the stitches out in a couple of weeks, and I waited a couple of months. And the problem with that is, first off, I just thought they would dissolve because I'm just like, oh, stitches dissolve. But of course, they were in my mouth, so if they were supposed to dissolve, they'd be gone within a minute, you know? Yeah. So that was bad on my part for thinking that, but the... second thing is that the tissue in your mouth is fairly thin, very close to the blood supply, so infections can happen very quickly. And I got a staph infection, the stitches got infected, and I ended up in the hospital for almost 2 months in Columbia Presbyterian.
Wow.
And so I went in, you know, I was kind of a jacked up 220 pounds, and at the end of it all I was about 160.
Wow.
Yeah. And really had to...
And these were 220 pounds pure muscle, and
well, not pure, but enough that I mean, I thought it looked great. But I would rather be alive than, you know, have to really focus that hard again on it. It just, not that, you know, I don't tend to believe those types of things happen just to teach you a lesson anymore. Kind of like when Brent died, my bishop saying God took him away because it was supposed to be a lesson for me. But I do think that there's something that can be learned from every situation. And I think maybe the universe was kind of like, you need to slow the fuck down.
Yeah.
You need to start focusing on what you came to New York to do. And it's not to look pretty and make as many friends as you can. It's to express who you are and be free to be who you are and to, you know, further your music stuff. So it took a while to recover from that. It was...
But we have to chase a few things in life.
Yeah,
We have to go down. Did you read Siddhartha by Hermann Hesse?
Uh-uh.
Oh, read it.
Okay.
I tell everybody that. You'll get it.
But all right.
Anyway, it's just that idea that you need to chase a few, you know, a few things before you really are going to understand what your priorities are. But
yeah,
it sounds like that helped you narrow down your priorities anyway.
Right, right. One was just being grateful to be healthy and alive versus trying to be the shiniest object on the block. You know, it's just dumb.
Thank you for joining us today on Gay Mormon Stories. To discuss this episode with others, please check us out at gaymormonstories.org. If you want to see this podcast continue, please consider making a monthly donation, again at gaymormonstories.org. All donations go directly towards keeping the podcast alive and towards building a community of support for lesbian, gay, bisexual, transgender, and queer Mormons. Music for this podcast was donated by George Parkinson and Kelly Clark Parkinson. My scanty meal was spent.
that